Committee on Natural Resources to order for Thursday, May 10th, 2007, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5513, the Department of Fish and Wildlife Budget Bill. Mr. Moore, we have kind of an issue, and what we're going to do is probably just continue through the hearing like everyone was here. But because of the situation they're in and sort of a crunch on the House side of getting bills out, I'm probably not going to have any House members this morning, and I'm hoping that Senator Nelson will be able to stay with me and Senator Avakian will show up soon. That actually might make this even a quicker process, to be honest.
We know enough to keep us.
But apologize for not having the other members here, but if I was to just delay, that would probably just slow down the entire process. So just begin wherever you want to begin, and this must be Captain Markey.
Yes, sir.
And I've been told by certain parties to give Captain Markey a difficult time. So.
Who can that be?
Terry Devlin, for the record, I'm Virgil Moore, the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And today what we want to do is have Captain Markey go over the Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Program, and then we want to have Ed Bowles begin the fisheries portion of the presentation today, and we'll try to move crisply through that. So with that, I'll turn it over to Captain Markey.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Walt Markey, Captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division. I supervise 119 Oregon State police officers who are assigned to the Fish and Wildlife Division. These troopers are strategically stationed throughout the state of Oregon in order to protect Oregon's natural resources. The Fish and Wildlife Division of the Oregon State Police is the only enforcement entity designated by law to protect the fish and wildlife resources throughout the state. The division has formed partnerships with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, the Oregon State Marine Board, and the Department of Environmental Quality. By forming these partnerships, the division is able to provide enforcement work, which helps further the mission of these other agencies. I would like to start my testimony today by telling you about four different key budget drivers or workload trends that is affecting how the division serves the citizens of Oregon. The first budget driver, which affects how the division does its business, is new laws and regulations. In order for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to meet their resource management goals, while still offering as much opportunity to the public as possible, new laws and regulations are adopted. These new laws are sometimes passed by legislation, but are more often passed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission. When a new law or regulation is introduced, the Fish and Wildlife Division is sometimes required to reorganize our resources and our priorities. Because the division's budget is comprised of 85% dedicated funding from several different funding sources, this leaves very little room to maneuver when trying to meet our agency needs. Let me give you an example. During the past year, the OFW Commission passed an administrative rule which set limits on how many commercial crab pots any particular commercial crabber may have in the ocean any one time. This was done at the urging of the commercial crab community with the goal to provide fresh crab over a longer period of time, which added some needed stability to this economically critical fishery. For several years now, Dungeness crab has been Oregon's largest fishery, which brings millions of dollars to Oregon's economy. This regulation requires a large offshore vessel for adequate enforcement. Oregon is the only coastal state in the United States which does not have a large offshore boat with enforcement capability. The division has several rigid hull boats that we currently operate offshore. However, these vessels do not have the ability to pull crab pots or to work offshore in bad weather. Stopgap measures are currently being used, such as partnering with Washington and California to use their large offshore vessels to patrol Oregon's waters for several days with Oregon Fish and Wildlife officers on board. The only cost to Oregon in this case was the fuel to run the vessels. By being resourceful, the division managed to effectively enforce the crab pot rule this year. However, a long-term solution must be found to effectively enforce this new rule. The second budget driver I want to talk about is calls for service. The division has documented that we are responding to a growing number of calls for service regarding public interaction with large predators such as bears, cougars, and wolves. Bear compliance hours are 21% higher than the previous six-year average. Bear violations have increased 29% over the same six-year period. Cougar compliance hours in the last 2 years have increased 12%. Cougar violations have increased 57% over the last 6 years. The division started tracking compliance rates involving wolves in late 2006, and we at this time have no comparisons to compare that to. The division is currently working to provide additional training for troopers on how to deal with the possibility of a large predator attacking a citizen, how to handle sightings of large predators by citizens, and educating the public on methods to prevent large predator contact. The third budget driver I'd like to talk about is Oregon's increasing population. Large population increases in portions of Oregon have exceeded our ability to provide adequate enforcement programs that we have in other areas of our state. In these areas, troopers mainly respond to individual complaints for service and are unable to dedicate proactive enforcement efforts towards identified high-priority programs to gain voluntary compliance, which is what we use to measure our success. For an example, Deschutes County is one of Oregon's premier locations for both resident and non-residents to enjoy outdoor activity. The population in Deschutes County has increased 54% from 1990 to 2000 and has increased an additional 22.5% since the year 2000. In addition, there are upwards of 90,000 people visiting Central Oregon communities as tourists, sportsmen, campers, and boaters. The compliance rate for wildlife violations in this area is 10% below the statewide average and 5% below the statewide average for fishing activities. The fourth budget driver I want to address is the division's staffing level and recruitment. Historically, the Fish and Wildlife Division recruited its members who have a specialized skill set from the Patrol Division. Over time, the Patrol Division has been depleted through budget cuts, which has reduced our pool of fish and wildlife applicants. This has made it difficult to fill vacancies within the Fish and Wildlife Division. Early in my career, the waiting list to work for the Fish and Wildlife Division was so long that troopers were required to work for 2 years in the Patrol Division before they could work in the Fish and Wildlife Division. During recent years, the division has started recruiting and hiring recruits with the skill sets we are looking for directly into the Fish and Wildlife Division. Currently, the division has a 6% vacancy rate, which equates to 6 vacancies. The vacancy rate is down from past years, where vacancies have been as high as 10%. Even though we still have vacancies within the Fish and Wildlife Division, we have recently been able to do a better job filling those vacancies. We continue to look for officers with the passion and the desire to apply their skills as a Fish and Wildlife officer. During the last biennium, the division implemented several improvements which made us more efficient. The division instituted a new web-based reporting system where the troopers manually enter the time and activities they perform each day. This system eliminated one support position which entered the data the troopers provided and significantly reduced the time that it takes command staff to access the data to compile our compliance rates. It used to take up to 6 months to access the data to where we are now able to access the data immediately. A second efficiency the division implemented was we have 2 limited duration support staff through a federal grant. One of these positions compiles reports which are required by various state and federal agencies. This position has reduced the workload of 15 supervisors and 26 troopers and the command staff at General Headquarters. The second position researches commercial fish landing data and provides support documentation to officers in the field for violations. Let me spend a few minutes telling you about the division's performance measures. The division has 3 performance measures which we track for the legislature, which helps us measure how successful we are. Through our new web-based tracking system, the division has the ability to track all wildlife that troopers come in contact with while on patrol. This information can be broken down by species, water body, or hunt unit, allowing the division to measure user impacts on various species. Once this information is collated, the information is used to evaluate programs, compliance rates, enforcement patrols, and assigned position locations. The first measure is the OSP performance measure number 4. This measures angler compliance by using the percent of anglers contacted who are angling in compliance with rules and laws associated with salmon and steelhead bag limits, licensing and tagging, including means of take and species. This performance measure has been in place for several years and has a target rate of 85%. The division's actual compliance rate in 2006 was 90.7%. The second measure is OSP measure number 5. This measures angler compliance by using the percent of anglers contacted who are in compliance with rules and laws associated with all species. This performance measure was put into place in the 2005 legislative session. The target rate of compliance for the performance measure is 85%. The division's actual compliance rate in 2006 was 89.6%. The third measure is OSP measure, performance measure number 6. This measures hunter compliance by using the percentage of hunters contacted who are hunting in compliance with the rules and laws associated with big game hunting seasons. The performance measure was put into place in the 2005 legislative session. The target rate of compliance for the performance measure is 87%. The division's actual compliance rate in 2006 was 86.9%. To summarize, the Fish and Wildlife Division met our goals for our statewide performance measures. However, as I have already testified, in certain areas of Oregon, such as Deschutes County, where population trends has affected our staffing levels' ability to be proactive, we have fallen below our goals. Some key legislation currently pending which could affect the division is Senate Bill 101. Under current law, the Oregon State Parks is allowed to spend monies it receives from its all-terrain vehicle program to pay enforcement agencies to enforce laws pertaining to all-terrain vehicles in areas where it is open to operate these vehicles. Currently, the division spends approximately 2,000 hours per year enforcing laws pertaining to the users of all-terrain vehicles. This amount of time equates to approximately 1.5 FTE. The majority of our enforcement is in areas where the use of these vehicles is closed. During the hunting seasons, our number one complaint is all-terrain vehicles operating in closed areas. Senate Bill 101 would allow Oregon State Parks to allocate funds from their all-terrain vehicle program to fund the work the division currently performs regarding all-terrain vehicles being operated in areas closed to these vehicles. I'll conclude my testimony today with some information in regards to policy packages in the ODFW budget that directly affects the Fish and Wildlife Division at OSP. Policy Package 140, Commercial Fisheries Management. As I mentioned earlier, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission implemented a crab pot limit on the commercial crab industry. This new program requires all commercial crab pots in the ocean, both coastal and deep water, to be marked with a tag identifying the owner of the pot. For this program to be successful, it requires a dedicated enforcement effort by the Fish and Wildlife Division. To effectively patrol this fishery, the Fish and Wildlife Division needs a boat capable of operating in deep water to inspect buoy tags, crab pots, and to pull the unlawful crab pots from the ocean floor. In addition, once the crab fishing season is closed, any crab pots left in the ocean are unlawfully fishing and must be removed as evidence and for preservation of the resource. Through Policy Package 140, ODFW provides $140,000 other funds to state police for the purpose of leasing an ocean-going vessel and crew for approximately 46 days split equally over 2 years. This lease would cover all the expenses for renting the vessel, skipper, and crew wage, fuel, and any other associated expenditure. Fish and Wildlife Division members would accompany the crew on these deep water enforcement patrols, which would be performed from various ports in Oregon. This policy option package will allow the division to achieve our goal of identifying gear and individuals engaging in unlawful deep water crabbing, stop the practice, and retrieve any equipment in violation in order to achieve the division's goal of 85% compliance. Policy Package 200, the Oregon State Police Enforcement. This package maintains Oregon State Police current enforcement levels with other funds made available through the hatchery fund shift in Package 201. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is covering the increased cost in its current contract with Oregon State Police, which provides enforcement of fish and wildlife laws. This increase in cost results partly from an OSP budget note in the 2005 legislative session that requiring them to make every effort to fill any position becomes vacant in the Fish and Wildlife Division in a timely manner. The budget note further states that positions in this division are not to be held vacant to ensure positions in other divisions of OSP can be filled. Prior to this budget note, OSP managed increasing personnel costs by maintaining a certain level of vacancies under their ODFW contract. The resulting cost to ODFW to keep positions filled over the current estimated budget level is $861,142. This amount equates to support for 4 fish and game officers. This request would continue contract funding to maintain effective enforcement of Oregon's fish and wildlife laws. designed to protect the state's natural resources. The other funds used in this package are made available through restoration of general fund in the agency's hatchery program. This concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Questions? I guess I could start off.
I'm just looking at this. I guess on page 146 that ODF is historic use hunting and to fund 61 positions, but they're asking for another 861. Is that, where is that all sitting?
Or 861,000.
Is that included? Or are, where, I'm all confused where we are in the governor's budget, the culture's budget.
Mr. Chair, so, members of the committee, maybe I can take a first stab at this. The $861,000 is the increased cost of funding the same amount of troopers as are funded in the current biennium. And part of this is really a budget construction problem, and this is a problem that the departments have seen in the past. For example, last session, under budget rules, special payments is what the department uses to pay for troopers at OSP can only go up 3.1% inflation. That's what it is this biennium. But obviously, personnel costs go up higher than that every biennium. So the department gets behind the eight ball or behind the curve if all they do is add 3.1% or the allowed inflation on special payments. So last session, the department was asked to work with OSP when they developed their budget to bring to you the true cost of providing the same amount of troopers for the full biennium. And that's what you see in front of you.
Okay.
And that would be funded with license dollars. And those would be proposed to be made. Those would be made available for this purpose through a fund shift in the hatcheries, putting general fund in hatcheries, and taking other funds out and putting them into this package. In the co-chair budget, there's no general fund for the hatcheries, so the hatcheries would stay on other funds of license dollars, and then the department would have to manage to that total revenue, other funds revenue. During the course of the biennium, you've heard the director describe the cycle that they're in on the license and tag fees. They're at the end of their cycle. They're getting to where their ending balance is really very thin to manage all the payroll and all the other costs they have during the biennium. So they're going to have a challenge during this next biennium of taking management actions such as holding positions vacant for a couple months, things similar to what you saw in Department of Corrections yesterday in their work session when they took an unspecified reduction. It, in essence, is equivalent to an unspecified reduction that the department has to manage to over the course of the biennium. If the department were to decide that the best way to manage to that cash flow was to close hatcheries, then that would be their decision. But you saw a list of 10% other fund reductions that they can go through, that they have prioritized, that they can go to before they have to close a hatchery.
And just to keep something in mind, that we are working to try to make sure that that doesn't happen. Just so if anybody's listening to this, I don't get 10 more emails.
I'll give a few Coastal Caucuses folks.
One question I would have in the difference in cost, is that the full cost of having the equivalent number of troopers, in a sense? Well, I mean from that, because I'm sure, like the rest of state police, one of your big cost drivers is the cost of fuel. And as we all know, that's been going up far faster than inflation. In fact, almost on a daily basis, goes up on by annual inflation rate almost on a daily basis.
That's for sure, isn't it?
But that must be part of your cost, isn't it?
Senator Devlin, it is, but to estimate the price of gas is very difficult. But
yeah.
We have determined that the $861,000 is what it would take to keep our department whole, to keep the amount of troopers that we have now in the field.
Mr. Chair, it is just the personnel costs.
Okay.
There's no allowance for additional increases for fuel.
So that will be a challenge that the agency will be facing. I believe we made some accommodation for the Measure 66 funded side of the program with an increase in the OSP budget for that, for some fuel. But because of the other fund situation the department's in, they really don't have any additional money to send off to OSP at this point.
Okay. Another question I had, Captain Marquis, when you were going through a couple of the items when you were talking about enforcement, particularly relative to bears and cougars, you mentioned two different items. Could you explain more clearly what you mean by those? I think one of them was like enforcement actions or...
Yes, Mr. Chair. We Fish and Wildlife officers sit down with ODFW biologists in February of each year. We sit down, we set what is the priorities for the year. What are the sensitive species, what's threatened, what do we need to spend our enforcement time on to better serve the citizens of Oregon to protect the natural resources. And once those priorities are set, we then schedule our shifts accordingly so that we make sure that we're in the right area at the right time to protect those species. And so each of our officers has a time card that they fill out at the end of the day, and every species has a code, every unit has a code, every creek has a code, there's a code for everything, so we can document very precisely what we're spending our time doing and what kind of activities we were enforcing. So we're able to track which species and area we're working on. We also track what the compliance rate is, how many people we contacted, how many were in compliance, and how many were not in compliance. And so what we're able to determine is that the compliance hours that we have to spend regarding bears has increased 21% over the last 6 years. We're able to see the trend that we're spending more and more time working with people who are out of compliance with bears. We're also able to document the violations have increased 29%.
Due to the shortages at the Oregon State Police and obviously the fact that a number of other law enforcement agencies, particularly in some counties that are losing forest-related funds, the decline in law enforcement personnel, are you finding that your game enforcement officers are being more often pulled? Not pulled, I'm not talking about by management of OSP, but just by necessity, that you might be the only law enforcement officer in the area for a case, pulled away from your normal enforcement activities?
Chair Devlin, yes, I have. We maintain that we're Oregon State Police officers first and game officers second. We're trained just as any other Oregon State Police officer. We just have a specialty to work in Fish and Wildlife. 17% of my budget is general fund monies. That allows me to become or to remain a state police officer. When a game officer is en route to the woods and an accident occurs and he's the only one in the area, he's going to go to the accident. And because our patrol officers have depleted to such a lower level, our game officers are spending more and more time responding to accidents, drunk drivers, all sorts of calls. So, yes, we have seen that, and I hold that 17% part of my budget very dearly, because without that, I wouldn't be able to do that as a state police officer. But to more specifically answer your question, yes, we are spending more time responding to calls other than Fish and Wildlife.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify one thing? When I said that this was the cost for the positions this biennium, it's the current cost of the positions this biennium. There is no allowance in this funding for increased costs due to the compensation plan that always gets negotiated and implemented during the biennium. So that will be a challenge that we'll be facing the assembly as we deal with the compensation plan.
Mr. Siebert, in that case, well, I guess it would depend upon as we reach agreement on those collective bargaining agreements and money is set aside, money would be allocated back based upon those agreements in most of these cases.
Mr. Chair, committee member, The way it works is they would give you limitation so that we would calculate the amount of other funds limitation that the department would need because of the increased costs. But there's no automatic allocation of those dollars, except in the case of the general fund, in which case the co-chair budget or the final budget usually sets a salary pot aside in emergency fund to deal with general fund issues. But for federal funds, other funds, and even lottery funds, we allocate additional money to agencies at the beginning of the biennium to deal with compensation. So the other funds and the federal funds, it is empty limitation unless the department has the ability to send more money.
So Captain Mark, he might see some adjustment for this 17% that's general fund, but the remainder he'd have to seek from elsewhere. And the question would be, is would the money be available elsewhere? Is that a
That's a fair question.
Okay. Well, we really didn't give you too bad of a time, so I'm going to get... Thank you very much for the presentation. Captain Markey, where do we go now, Mr. Moore?
Senator Devlin, we have Ed Bowles, our fisheries administrator. We want to get started on the fisheries budget, portion of the budget, and so I'm going to ask Ed Bowles. And he's already there. If you remember, this is the biggest piece of the pie in our budget.
Chair Devlin and committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator. I'm going to give you a very brief overview. I've cut this down quite a bit, but it's found in pages 73 through 115 of the Ways and Means document. I'll first just give you a quick background and then get into the budget and policy packages that we have, the program packages. Fish Division really focuses on two main areas as our charge. One is providing fisheries, and the other is ensuring and maintaining healthy fish populations. Now, bringing forward that in a balanced way is a delicate thing and a very challenging thing. We've got a significant agency effort to try to meet both of those two objectives. As Director Moore mentioned, Fish Division is the largest component of the agency. We have about 72% of all the full-time equivalent employees, about 55% of all the expenditures occur within Fish Division. Most of these positions, though, are field-oriented positions on the ground. We've got over 94% of all those positions are located in our out of headquarters in these field-oriented programs. Now, we have four programs in order to implement this, in addition to the regional structure that Director Moore talked about, that it houses all of our hatcheries and stuff. The budgetary side of this comes under four overall programs. Everything else flows out of that. There's propagation, natural production, marine resources program, and what we call our interjurisdictional program, which deals with Columbia River and ocean salmon. I'm going to just briefly touch on each of those programs, give you a flavor of important things they're doing. And propagation is really another term for the hatcheries. It's not just hatcheries, but that's the key component of it. We have 34 hatcheries, 28 satellite facilities, and 25 step propagation programs. That's the Salmon Trout Enhancement Program. Collectively, it's over 40 million salmon and steelhead and trout released each year. This program, in addition to hatcheries, also includes the associated marking programs, fish health programs, and some of our engineering program. One thing I just wanted to mention is that our hatcheries as facilities also provide a real strong value to the public in just visitation aspects. We have about 1.5 million visitors to our hatchery system each year, and those range all the way from folks, you know, educational opportunities to just picnicking opportunities and getting a chance to get out, all for free, mind you. Natural production embraces several different programs within it. It's vital to both the fishery and our conservation objectives, and this is where we house one of our key programs, which is the Conservation and Recovery Program. It's got 10 primary functions outlined for you on page 93, but I'm just going to focus on a few of those because of the time limitations. one I wanted to mention was the R&E program, which is restoration and enhancement. This is a surcharge on sport and commercial fishing that began in late 1980s. It sunsets in 2009. And this one's really excellent. It provides a dedicated fund for hatchery improvements, watershed enhancement, angler access, education, fish passage, a whole number of things. We had $5 million over the past biennium. That $5 million, and this is an important piece of this, it leveraged $15 million in matching dollars, and we allowed us to complete over 100 projects. That included help with Diamond Lake, as you're well aware of, warm water habitat structures, access, other things. Another very important program to us is the screening and passage program. This is provides funding and technical support to reduce the impacts of diversions and barriers. It's a cost share program, and so it really is great because it provides a tax credit and this cost share match in order to encourage water users to voluntarily screen their diversions for just the screening piece of it. This past biennium, we had over 120 screens installed in spite of significant federal budget reductions, because this is part of a package program. There was $1.1 million in matching funds from the water users themselves. So I want to stress this is a very important program from that standpoint. They had $500,000 just in in-kind match, and so we're very pleased with that program, and it's worked forward. The federal funding limitations is something we need to really keep our eye on, though. STEP program, I only bring that up, but this is the Salmon Trout Enhancement Program, which is another local volunteer-based sort of effort. It's to help recover fisheries. Began in 1981, so I bring it up because it had its 25th anniversary this past year. It does education, inventory, habitat, and production. It's got this past year in 2006, 15,000 volunteers, of which 9,000 were youth, and completed over 1,200 projects. I think I'll shift down to marine resources just to keep things flowing. This one helps protect manage oceans, marine fisheries, and shellfish. Four primary sub-programs, groundfish, shellfish, and ocean salmon, as well as operations. This one is really housed outside of our headquarters office. It's in Newport with offices in Astoria, Tillamook, Charleston, and Brookings. Our last program is the interjurisdictional program. As I mentioned earlier, this is the Columbia River Ocean Salmon. It also has our fish division and regional operations, so kind of the admin portion of that. It assesses status of salmon, steelhead, sturgeon, and smelt populations and manages these in the Columbia River and ocean. Now, like the Marine Resources Program, both of these have tremendous interjurisdictional aspects. So we co-manage with the federal government, with other state governments, tribal governments, and international treaties with Canada. So that's kind of all I've prepared right now for the background. I'd like to now get into some of the key issues that are identified for you on pages 74 through 77. There's 20 of them there. I'll just touch on a couple that relate to the budget. The deferred maintenance piece we'll talk about a little bit later, but this has been a long-standing issue. The legislature has been very concerned about our need to protect the infrastructure that we have, particularly with our hatcheries, but also our other facilities. So we've completed a master plan to deal with those deferred maintenance issues, and we have a program package to begin addressing this, so I'll talk more about that later. Wanted to bring up fish health, which is a key issue, and Director Moore talked about the IHN virus and other pathogens. Very important for us to keep ahead of this to ensure these pathogens protect not only our fish, but also the watersheds that they reside in and the public. And I bring this up because I don't know if you've been tracking the news, the issue of melamine and some of the pet feed that has been out there has caused tremendous concerns. And we've just recently this week been notified of some of the melamine located in fish food that we've gotten from a Canadian company.
Ronald, there was a report on a local radio station yesterday.
to that effect. So.
We have provided, as soon as we found out about this, we have provided a news release, and that's where Chair Devlin, that story came from. This is not just a local issue. It's national and international. This is actually a product made from coal that is used for fire retardant, plastics, other things. Just briefly, what has actually happened is some of the essential building blocks of different feeds, in this case it's wheat gluten and flour, has had this melamine added to it from Chinese companies in order to falsely enhance the protein, the measured protein in it, which then goes in and meets the protein count, gets into fish feeds. And so we are very proactively addressing this. We want to make sure that not only our fish, but the public that consumes those fish have all the information they need. The public has all the information they need. We're doing good protective measures. We're right now looking at sorting out exactly what feed has it. Initially it looked like one hatchery. Now it looks like a lot more hatcheries have received different batches of this. We want to make sure that all of that is cleared up, and then we are in the process of looking at setting up labs to look at the actual flesh of the fish to see if there's anything residing there. This is not a product that bioaccumulates readily into the flesh, but we want to make sure that is not going to be a problem, just to be safe. And just after information I received this morning, I feel much more optimistic that we'll get through this fine, because I think that the levels we'll find will be very, very low. So, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention because it is in the news and is part of this overall package of maintaining good fish health. Another key issue is fish recovery. I'm not going to touch much on this. I had the opportunity to present some of this to Representative Dingfelder's committee over in the House. We're basically aggressively looking at 12 federally listed salmon and steelhead populations to help the federal government develop recovery plans. Another element of this is the pinniped issue. I'll just mention that it's taking a lot of staff time and will take a lot of staff time into the future in order to pursue some of our permits from the federal government to continue that hazing up to and including lethal take if necessary as a last resort. I won't say any more on that unless you have questions. Lastly, last issue, because it relates to budget, and you'll see in a lot of our program packages, on the marine side, the groundfish management is very important. We've had reductions of federal funding. We're scrambling to fill in those voids through alternative funding packages, most of it the commercial fish fund. And so that is, as you're well aware, it's been a very hot legislative topic as well, the groundfish fishery, and that is something we're working to ensure we've got the information adequate to meet the demands of managing those species. So those cover the key issues. If you have any other questions, I'd take those. Otherwise, Chair Devlin, I'd like to move into our program packages. I think those begin on page 81. All right, and on here we've got 11 program packages, but there's a lot of subcomponents to several of these, particularly in the marine program. And so I thought what I just did this morning was I'm going to go through really with just one-liners, because this could take a lot of time to go through, but I wanted to touch on each, and then I can answer questions for any of the details, if that's all right, Chair Devlin. Within propagation, as I mentioned, that begins on 81. We have five. The 110 program package is for the what we call CEDC, the Clackamas County Economic Development Commission. That one is a general fund for $160,000. That's been flat funded for 6 years, and we're really out of balance now with what the fishermen are providing towards that. They're actually funding 50% of that particular program, that element of this. And This one, I'd mentioned, is in the governor's recommended budget, but not in the co-chair's. The next one, package 120, is...
I just want to let you know that I've had more communications about this than I have had in the co-chair's $10 million reduction in Head Start. So...
this particular program has, Chair Devlin, many passionate followers of this, and it provides, I just mentioned that this isn't just about providing fishing opportunities. This Select Area Fishery Program is a conservation effort in order to be able to harvest fish commercially in the Columbia River outside of the main area of the river where the wild fish that are listed and causing such angst upriver with the dams and everything else. We don't want those fishery impacts to be too high, and so we've moved these into the margins of the river and allowed the gillnetters to harvest them there with much, much fewer impacts on the listed fish. And so this is very important, not only from a fishery standpoint, but from a conservation standpoint. Package 120 deals with hatchery rent and a union issue with nighttime on-call that was agreed to. I won't spend any more on that unless you have questions. Package 130 within propagation is the simple limited duration to permanent positions. These all have had 5-plus years, and so the good... and for this particular one, it's only a Big Creek Hatchery position here, but there you'll find these also in other programs. The package 150 is limited duration to limited duration. So these are simply ones that roll over that have less than 5 years or not secure future funding. And so we continue those over with limited duration. And the one in prop is the Willamette Hatchery staff person. And then 201 is, Chair Devlin, is what you were just discussing with Captain Marquis and Director Moore. Senator Nelson, you brought this up. This is the hatchery fund shift. It's a package that, from our standpoint, is really closely tied to the program package 200 with Oregon State Police, and really is a close tie between those. The $860,000 going to Oregon State Police of other fund license is backfilled with $861,000 equivalent general fund in the governor's recommended budget. Very important to us that this does not come at the expense of those hatcheries, including the Salmon River Hatchery, having international ties to the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which puts significant things at risk. So I hope that's able to be worked out. Switch now to natural production.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm late. I was up on the floor. But when you talk about the tie between those two, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what was happening currently. So we have... The governor's recommended budget was proposing a backfill of what currently was being funded out of, I guess, tag fees and license fees, and with general fund. And, you know, that's not a reality. That's a proposal by the governor, obviously. The co-chair said, no, we're not doing that. And then what I don't know is that the co-chairs who then said, so go close those two hatcheries instead, or is that the department's response? Because I'm not going to support closing hatcheries. That's just not going to happen, on this side of the table, which is not very big, I understand. But I want to get to the bottom of what's currently happening and then where we go by the funds if it's not going to come out of the police enforcement side, in which I'm not saying it should, but you know, we're going to have to get into this deeper. Now, you might have been into this and I was gone, so I maybe...
Well, actually, you never want to say something has been solved in this building until the actual gavel comes down. Because
you're working on it. Maybe I should just draw my question and you can keep working on it. But
I think we're doing everything possible to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think we have a solution in the works. But you never want to say everything is done until the gavel comes down on in both chambers on the budget, and the governor signs the bill.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Klein, we went over this a little bit before when we talked about the state police, and I would just, to your question, I would say it's LFO's contention that the co-chair budget does not close hatcheries.
Right then. Moving on.
But your concern has been noted, and you're in a long line of people expressing a concern. So, anything more, Representative Klein?
No.
Okay. Okay. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, I will move now into the natural production program with the policy option packages beginning on page 96. There are three in this program with a couple of them with subcomponents. I'll first discuss package 113. There are two elements to this. One is, as we discussed earlier, the limited duration to permanent rollover, and this is an ongoing position with the Clackamas County Department of Transportation, helping them go through the permit process and everything else to ensure those transportation projects are fish-friendly. And this is non-licensed other fund, just making that permanent. And then the second element of this are two new limited duration positions that are not permanent, which is part of the mitigation requirements under the FERC license for the Pacific Corps Prospect Dam project. And so this will be doing inventory work and fish analyses.
On this package with Clackamas County, is this primarily related to the Sunrise Corridor and all the work they're having to do there?
Chair Devlin, I'm not certain where they're actually going to be doing this work, but it's throughout where they've received their funding, much of it federal, to do work, and it's throughout the county now. I can get back to you on the specific projects if you'd like. I don't have that information right now.
I just recall that they've had a number of significant and environmental issues with some of those projects.
Chair Devlin, this is ongoing. This is not a new position, and so it would be related to projects that have already been working on.
Okay.
Program package 150 is limited duration to limited duration, so simply rolling those over with the not making permanent seven positions that relate to the Columbia River Snake River monitoring programs, as well as monitoring and broodstock management at Marmot Dam on the Sandy River. And this is federal and non-licensed other fund. Program package 160 has two elements to it. One of them is Nonpareil Dam on the Umpqua. It's where we have a genetic pedigree study going on. And the second one is Lower Columbia River monitoring, which is a program that was begun last session. We want to make that more permanent. It's to duplicate coastal coho monitoring efforts that we did on the coast using the same techniques. Very important to help us move forward with those recovery plans. And both of those are lottery fund program packages. I'd like to shift now to marine. The policy option packages begin on page 105. First one there is pinniped predation package, where they're preying on threatened and endangered species. This is a package that currently we do not have federal funds secured yet. It was put in the program in anticipation of some federal funds to help us move forward on our Section 120 permit and other hazing activities associated with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And if we are able to get that limitation or the future funding, we'll certainly, I don't anticipate a problem getting this put in at a future time if necessary.
package 140 has four elements to it, as well as two other ones a little bit outside of Fish Division within our OSP and ASD. But I'll cover the four within Fish Division. The first element of this is pack fin shortfall, which is the commercial fishing database system and how we manage those. It's commercial groundfish sampling, the groundfish and whiting, strong shortfall that occurred there that was filled in last session. This makes that shift permanent using commercial fish fund as the approach to do that. The second piece initiates the nearshore program, which has been ongoing with state wildlife grant money, part of the conservation strategy. This would initiate that program not at its full level, but simply maintain that current operations forward so that we can continue doing critical work with the state conservation strategy to secure long-term funding for that. So this just moves the existing program, which is on its initial phases, forward, but it is a part of the state conservation strategy. That is commercial fish fund as well. The third element is simply an administrative fix that because of federal funding shortfalls, we're going through and doing a realignment within the program to make sure everybody working on commercial fish is actually funded with commercial fish dollars and everybody working on recreational fish are funded with recreational fish dollars. And so it's a necessary realignment because things are getting so tight with federal funds. And the fourth one is an estuary position out of our Northwest region. This would be actually service the mid-coast and the south coast areas of the coast for estuary habitat work, technical advice, and inventories. We've got a lot of environmental issues going on in our coastal bays right now. And it's very important that we keep up with the permitting process and providing good customer service as those projects move forward so that they're ecologically sound. And so this is a new position. The two that I mentioned...
Why don't you finish that? Then I had a general question.
Okay. The two that are not directly within Fish Division, I just wanted to mention, they may come up later, are the... or already came up... Captain Marquis mentioned the OSP boat rental. This is just an S piece as a one-time fix. Hopefully we'll be able to help them get a vessel in the future, but this is just to get them through the rental piece for a very important enforcement. And the other one, with the new crab pot limits that went into place, it's put an additional strain on our Administrative Services Division, and so to help implement those new rules and rules that are to come with permit stacking and other things. This is a position within that with commercial fish funds.
On your last comment about leasing being a temporary arrangement, I would hope that when we got to a point in the future making a decision whether to purchase, we would look at whether a lease was could be potentially more cost effective depending upon the circumstance. But a general question I had, and it's not so much because of your package here, it's because of one of your performance measures, which we'll still keep as a performance measure, but income level for commercial fishermen, both for fisheries that are associated with the state and outside the state. If I was an individual citizen, and which I am, and I wanted to go and find out what the condition was of commercial fisheries, or in terms of the commercial fishing industry in the state, and knowing that several years back, I believe, there was a buyout of some of the fisheries operations because of the limited availability in terms of, and then, of course, because of the, elimination of one season, we had basically an economic package to help individuals get by for that. Where would I go? Who would actually be able to tell me if whether the commercial fishing industry has stabilized in the state or whether it's still declining?
Chair Devlin,
really your best place. I mean, there's numerous places to go, but I think if there are questions on that, as a public, our marine resources program does a tremendous amount of outreach relative to how the fleet is doing, both commercial and sport, and how it is faring relative to its economic viability. But that's kind of the one stop. As far as, you know, many of these fisheries are actually managed through what is called the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which is basically advises the federal government on how to manage most of the fisheries. And then we do the territorial sea, which is out to 3 miles. And so most of those fisheries that affect Oregon relative to the commercial side are really under those auspices, and that's a big bureaucratic entity. A lot of folks have tried to sort out all the details of how folks are doing. So I wouldn't recommend that you go there, but we would use that information to advise you. Now, there are commissions, for example, the Crab Commission, there's the Pacific Salmon Commission, the trollers, all of those have their viable economic, you know, commercial groups that have their own non-governmental organizations that actually track their industry and provide feedback. We would use that information to sort it all out and provide a good, complete package. I want to just mention briefly, you talked about the balancing of personal income versus just managing the fish. And part of the way that we, as a state, have done that in the past is by ensuring that these fisheries don't have so many people participating in them that no one individual can make a viable living in it. And so it's through the limited entry program that the legislature has designated many of these fisheries, crab being one of them. Once you're in it, then you're it's managed so that you maintain viable within that. And so there is almost all of our fisheries are what are called limited entry commercial fisheries to try to balance the income versus the amount of fish available to catch. Very few are open access fisheries now for commercial side. I'm going to shift to program package 190, which is 6 components. I'm going to go through this very quickly. First one is the commercial black and blue rockfish component with other fund. It's really to deal with a new developing fishery called the live fish fishery in our territorial waters. This is a result of a higher ad valorem tax passed by the legislature, so we're just fulfilling our needs there. Pacific halibut recreational fishing monitoring is through just a S&S issue with other fund license. Recreational shellfish program, we're finally getting that. We know now how our funding stream is relative to that new funded license, and so we're looking for 4 new positions, 2 FTEs. We only have 1 now to get that program truly off the ground. The shellfish population assessment is really tied to that. It's the 4th element here, and these are LDs. These are one time. It's 7 positions and just over 4 FTEs that are really kind of a hit team to jumpstart the bay clam information. We haven't looked at that in nearly 30 years, and so we can really start inventorying information so that we can start making good management decisions, and so that'll get that off the ground. Developmental fisheries, which is a separate program as part of our commercial fish fund, and we'll have a seasonal position for sampling within that that is part of responding to a legislative intent. And then also within this developmental fisheries, it's a one-time use of some ending balance within that dedicated and obligated account towards it's $270,000 to examine not only the conservation needs of some of these fish that are in the developmental fisheries, but also to look at the overall program and provide feedback. Chair Devlin, I will move on to our interjurisdictional program if there are any questions on the marine program. And here we have one package, 112. This eliminates two positions and almost 1.25 FTEs. This one was its work in the Lower Columbia River in Willamette, focused on ESA needs. Our agency recommended budget actually requested a fund shift from federal funds and other funds to lottery funds, and the governor's recommended budget did not want to support the lottery fund component of this, so it cut all but 1/4 of these two positions. These are vital recovery needs. We're working with LFO and OEB right now for looking at alternatives to that that doesn't compromise the governor's recommended budget. There are also a couple other key recovery programs that are being reviewed with LFO for alternative funding. The coho monitoring on the coast, which is a long-standing program, and our Willamette recovery program leadership on that. So those are two that we're working on.
Mr. Chair, if I might just remind the committee that last session, as part of the agreement with NOAA Fisheries on use of Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds, we agreed as a state that we would direct some of those dollars to recovery planning for some of the listed species. And I believe what you heard Ed describe is a continuation of those efforts into the next biennium.
Chair Devlin, that is correct. You know, we'll be using those. We had hoped to be done with some of that earlier. Those federal recovery plans are taking longer to complete, and so we're rolling those over if possible. Chair Devlin, that concludes Fish Division program packages. Are there any further questions?
Any questions? Okay. She didn't say anything, but she understands that 2/3 of my questions normally came from this side. So,
want me to go ahead? All right. Have a little time. I'll go ahead and Chair Devlin, if we could, I'll cover some of the capital improvements, and there's one on the deferred maintenance piece of that.
It's almost back.
So it's 161 is where that kind of begins, and I'll just speak briefly to that package. And I'd mention, you know, that we've got a huge comprehensive report on the maintenance master plan that was completed in 2005, and we do have the executive summary here for your reference if you want to dig into that. But we have over 1,400 maintenance projects identified, you know, totaling over $9.1 million. We're only asking within this program package, and it's a program package 100, for $2.43 million, and this is likely the most that we can get spent in this next biennium, given existing staff, okay? And these are focused on health and safety issues. We want that as our top priority. And then the high priority, they scaled these in different priorities, and this will take care of most of our high priority projects as well in order to get that total. We also have other deferred maintenance monies that come from other programs. I mentioned the R&E program that provides deferred maintenance monies of $1.5 million available, and the deferred maintenance account. But we just use the interest earnings off of that account, which is approximately $400,000 for the biennium. So if we are able to receive this program package, we believe that the deferred maintenance corrections will reduce the backlog that the agency has, Chair Devlin, by about 12% per year. Not fully meeting the needs, but certainly getting a very important first step in this. That's all I have on that.
If that were funded and you were doing about 12% per year, deferred maintenance is something that always grows, in a sense. Some things today not deferred maintenance, but next year it'll be deferred. In a sense, something else will occur. Would that mean that your deferred maintenance level will decline by that much at this level, or would you just stabilize how much deferred maintenance you have?
Chair Devlin, as I understand it, that will take care of the backlog at a rate of 12% of the backlog. Maintenance ongoing, we would primarily dedicate those limited funds I talked to you about earlier, which is in the maintenance account and the R&E, in order to try to hold our ground, so to speak. Perhaps Lori Byerly can enhance on that a little more if I didn't hit that right. But it does not cover the new maintenance, as I understand it. That's the backlog.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'm just trying to equate this to something else, and that, for instance, in higher education, we need to spend about $80 million a biennium just for the backlog not to grow. This is probably a pretty good point to stop for today, and then we'll be back Monday, and I should have the House members back on Monday. They're not going into session at 8:30 on Monday. I believe they're going to do Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I would like to actually see what we could do to at least have some of the House members in and out on Tuesday, because that'll be the day that we have public hearings. And I think for the public hearings, we should try to have both chambers represented. So, and then if we need to, we will finish up on Wednesday. So we might as well post it for that, because we won't be doing anything else on Wednesday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe we might have another bill scheduled for Wednesday. Senate Bill 29 might be on the schedule at this point.
I'll have to check that one back.
Okay. Then if so, I will check.
Unless they moved it forward.
I will check with the scheduler. But we will certainly add ODF&W to Wednesday's schedule.
Okay. Well, I'll close the public hearing, and we're adjourned for today, and thank you all for your presentations.
Thank you.